The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 83.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I really, really enjoy talking to. He was one of the first YouTubers that I actually was able to talk econ with. He is one of the best out there. You've got to check out his YouTube channel. He is the Uneducated Economist. Mr. Economist, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Thank you very much, George. I really appreciate you bringing me on my show again.
You know what video I like? That one video that you had that just really crushed it on the views. You got like 30,000 views.
Which one was that?
The partial opening and why the economy will fail with the partial opening. Because you're talking about restaurants. Because they don't make money unless they're at like 90% capacity. So who's going to open up a restaurant just to go back to 50% capacity? And then you got to bring all your employees back, and they're making more money on unemployment. Then they're going to be pissed off at you back off at unemployment. And then you're still losing money because the margins are so thin that it's just a lose-lose situation.
Yeah, and I got that from, like, you know, real-world information. I mean, I know a few restaurant owners here in my local area, and, you know, when you hear, like, three of them say the same thing, you're like, wow, this is really the case here. I mean, you know, when they lose all that inventory, it's like, trying to get reestablished is, like, a very big commitment, and if you don't have the sales to go with it, it's going to be devastating to them. So,
when you're talking about inventory, you're just talking about the food, right? Because it obviously talking goes bad, so they got to get more.
Right. And so, you know, restocking the shelves, essentially, you know, to have all that on hand. And, you know, really, if you're sitting in a situation where, you know, especially with these restaurants, according to these guys, it's like, you know, you have to have a decent menu. You can't have just like four or five items on the menu. You know, you have to have a list. And to have that food on hand, ready to be prepared, is a commitment. And if you don't have the sales, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be very tough. I mean, restaurants are already a tough business to be in general. So
that's a great point. And then there's economies of scale that I didn't even think about. So it's not like your profit on one plate of food is the same compared to the exact same plate served 1,000 times, because your costs go down substantially. Obviously, you have the fixed costs and rent and whatnot, but I would assume that even your fluctuating costs, the cost of goods sold, if you want to look at a profit and loss, that actually would go down because you're able to buy more inventory at the same time. Yeah, because, like, as an example with the McDonald's, this is probably a bad example. Let's say a normal hamburger place that wasn't a franchise. Then if they go to their supplier and they buy a pound of beef, it's going to be a lot higher price than if they buy 100 pounds of beef or 1,000 pounds of beef. So, so their cost of goods sold actually go up at the same time when their gross revenue is going down. I mean, they're getting squeezed from every direction there.
All right. And then, not to mention, I mean, it's probably a little bit smaller on the scale of cost, but it's still, you know, an added price into it, is that from a lot of these rules and regulations that they have with these restaurants, you know, only allowing so many people to come in, but it's also, they have to wear masks and gloves, and they have to switch these things out every time they deal with another customer. So if you have a, you know, a wait staff who's helping, you know, 6-7 different tables, every time they go to that table, they have to remove everything they have, throw it away, and start off again with fresh masks, fresh gloves, you know. And so it's like a constant churning of this, of these items, even though, like I said, it's probably a smaller, you know, price on the scale, but it's still, you know, it's still added cost going into just trying to serve the customers, you know, wearing these masks and gloves, and then reestablishing, you know, boundaries that people can sit in, you know, barriers to keep people from being able to, you know, say sneeze across the table. It's just like, you know, everything that these restaurants are going through. And then, you know, a lot of these guys that I was talking with, some of them have just recently remodeled their place. So it's just like, you know, I just already remodeled my place. I can't remodel it again to, you know, to have these barriers up and all this, you know, social separating that's going to take place within the dining room itself. A lot of them are just like, I'm not going to do it. I'm just, you know, just straight up.
And then have you talked to them about their insurance costs? Because that's one thing I was thinking about. Their liability insurance has got to, I would assume, would skyrocket because, you know, before you would just have your liability, some kid trips or knocks out his teeth or something like that, or
sure,
someone gets sick as a result of the food they eat. But now all of a sudden, what if someone goes into your restaurant and gets COVID, and heaven forbid, it's some 80-year-old person that dies as a result? I mean, do you have the family coming back and suing you, especially in the United States, or it's so litigious?
You're right. No, I didn't even think about, you know, insuring against the against somebody getting sick from COVID on that. I just, you know, that didn't even cross my mind on it. But that is a great question. I'm certainly going to ask some of these guys I know about that and see what they have to say about it. But yeah, that's a very interesting point that you bring up there. You
know? Yeah, it's just with the liability, to your point, maybe having to reconfigure the restaurant itself. Who knows what other costs will come down the pipeline as far as adhering to additional regulations due to health and safety. And it's just, I don't see how these smaller businesses and the mom and the pop shop really survive. And I think that was the point of your video. And what's interesting too is the United States already is a country of just massive chains. You don't really see that too much. Like, I'm in Medellin, Colombia right now, as you know, and I spend a lot of time all over the world. And you see that in some places too. Like, they have McDonald's here and whatnot, but it's not like 90% of the restaurants are these chains that you recognize, like a Burger King, McDonald's, TGI Fridays, Olive Garden, whatever. So you've got this component of the United States where like 90% of the restaurants are already that way. So does this just eliminate the other 10%? So those are going to be your only options moving forward? What do you think?
Yeah. Well, it very well could be, you know, in my area. Like, I'm a very, you know, out here on the coast, we're very like tourist oriented area. So like, you know, tourism is like a big part of our income here in right. Clatsop County and Astoria. And most of our restaurants here, like, we don't really have a lot of chains. We do have like the Burger King, McDonald's, stuff like that. But almost all the restaurants and bars are all privately owned, you know, just, you know, somebody might own one or two of them, but usually it's just like, you know, they own the one restaurant. And yeah, I mean, to think that they're going to get wiped out, that would wipe out like 90% of our, you know, of our restaurants here. We really don't have that many chains.
So it's the opposite in your area. So that takes it to another level in the sense that this could impact rural areas and tourist areas even more so than the big cities.
Yeah. And, you know, we really, it would. I mean, especially us, like I said, you know, because we're, you know, the hospitality industry, we have a lot of hotels, we have a lot of restaurants. That's kind of like our big thing here. And, you know, we have like for lack of better terms, like, you know, a lot where the hipsters hang out, you know,
yeah.
We have like these really trendy places. And they're with the difficulty that they're having and experiencing right now, if we don't have that type of, you know, atmosphere going with these trendy restaurants, you know, that are unique, there's nobody gonna, I mean, who would come? I mean, who would want to, you know, who would want to come and spend money just to, I mean, you can come and, you know, view the nice scenery and stuff, but, you know, people want that atmosphere. They want to go and hang out at the nice places. And if they're not open and doing business, then we're not getting the revenue coming into our area.
Right. So therefore, I mean, what do you see potentially happening just your local area with unemployment?
Well, that's the interesting part about it is that, you know, with the unemployment right now, because it was like at first when I was listening to people talk about how difficult it was to try and even get their unemployment filed, just from the backlog of people and just the overwhelming, you know, amount coming into the centers there trying to get their unemployment even started. A lot of people are getting that extra $600 and they're spending that. And what I found at first, because, you know, I work at a lumber yard, I work at, you know, hardware and do, you know, home improvements, new home, you know, products and stuff like that. The first beginning of the lockdown, it was like ghost town. And I mean, I was thinking, okay, and we're even talking with the owner of the company and stuff. It was just like, well, here's some of the options that we're going to have to go through. We may end up needing to lay off some people because, you know, the lack of sales and stuff like that. But then something very strange that nobody was expecting to happen is that all of a sudden we started having a lot of sales, and like really? The transactions were just flying
Simon,
off the
charts.
Simon,
what's the timeline there?
February, awesome month. I mean, you know, it's mineral winter, so we were expecting, you know, you get a slowdown. It's just like anticipated, but they were doing well. You know, I mean, there was a lot of sales happening and stuff like that. But then the lockdown threats started coming in, and getting towards the end of March, it was getting very scary. And yeah, come like the very end, the last week of March is when we were talking this, like, okay, we're going to, you know, have to talk about cutting hours, maybe cutting a day out, cutting, you know, maybe some staff.
Right.
You know, he was getting us prepared. He was telling us like all the options that he has for, you know, we can take some sick leave, you know, do some stuff to try and keep some revenue or keep your paychecks going. And he was looking into the, you know, before the PPP thing got really, you know, real popular there, you know, he was talking about all these options that might come. By the middle of April, business was flying. I mean, it was really picking up. And I noticed it started with paint. Of all things, it was started with paint, and we were selling like just an insane amount of it. And I was like, well, what's going on here? And, you know, we got to talking about it. I was like, well, people are locked down. So they're like upgrading their homes. Right. They're painting their rooms to make themselves feel better about being at their house. You know, they're getting, you know, they have like old walls. They don't like the color anymore. They want to feel, you know, feel better about being locked in their house. So, you know, they start painting their walls. So it started there, and then it started moving into pressure treated lumber. And I thought, well, why pressure treated lumber? It's like, well, you know, they have, again, they want to be, you know, in a comfortable atmosphere. So they start rebuilding their decks, rebuilding their fences, you know, doing the different things like that. And so we saw a lot of people coming in, especially the do-it-yourselfers were coming in like in droves. And we were just overwhelmed at one point over the weekends as just massive amounts of people were coming in to do their home improvement projects. It was just very, we were not expecting it. It was a little bit overwhelming at one point. And I was like, well, where did all this come from? And it was at the same time the stimulus checks were coming in and people were getting that extra revenue, the extra $600 a week. And so people had the money, you know? And so we actually saw how that stimulus package was actually working for us. And since everybody else was locked down, like I said, we're a major like kind of hospitality restaurants and stuff like that. And none of those places were open. They didn't really have any other place to spend their money. And at the same time, we're like, again, I'm in a small community, so it's not like we have, you know, a bunch of places that you can go to buy this type of stuff. The other, we have like three lumber yards in the entire county, right? So us, Home Depot, there's another one on the far end of the county. And this is like right when the lockdown started kicking in, and then the social distancing, and then pretty soon they were like Home Depot was limiting the amount of people that could come into their store. So they had these really long lines to get into the store, and people were like, hey, let's head on down to the local lumberyard place, you know, over there on the other end of the county. And they were just coming in droves, and it was amazing. I mean, it was very surprising. We were not expecting that at all.
That is really interesting. It's so great to hear this and kind of like the boots on the ground. You've got the experience. You're kind of in the trenches every day. So my next question is inflation. How does that work out?
I like to track 2x48 standard and better. That's like the most common piece of lumber that you could possibly buy in a lumber yard is a 2x48 stick of lumber. Okay. And so I keep my eye on that price because that's the one that moves the most. Like, you know, doors, windows, and maybe like, you know, some of the bigger beams and stuff like that, they don't move as much as the pricing of a 2x48 does. And so I watch that comparatively to the future prices because, you know, obviously the mills are at future prices when it comes to, you know, selling per 1,000 board feet. And when you're down at the retail prices, there's something very different taking place there. And so, yeah, right now I'm looking at a 2x48 selling for $3.95. Okay. Well, at the height of the price, when futures were at $6.50 per thousand, now that was, I think that was towards the probably the last quarter, the fourth quarter of 2017, we saw future prices at $6.50 per thousand. And a 2x4 was selling for $4.29. Well, now we got future prices at around $3.50, $3.60 per thousand. And that 2x4 selling for $3.95. And there's like the supply and demand, like they parked all the planes. Well, mills curtailed development. and the inventory had tightened up dramatically. And so to even get your hands on 2x48s right now, or, well, I mean, you can get them, they're out there, but they're getting more expensive on the retail end of things because nobody really has any to sell. Even like, so I do a lot of ordering for the yard, you know, and like, again, 4x4, 10-foot pressure treated, one of the weird things out there you wouldn't expect to be gone, but I cannot find them to buy anywhere. I mean, it's just like people want these things for their decks, for their fences, for, you know, a lot of different purpose. And I cannot get my hands on a 4x4, 10-foot pressure treated. And when I asked the supplier about it, he says, we can't get them either. The mills are just not, simply just not making them. And
so are they not making them because they're not having the employees come in because of the virus, because everyone's on lockdown?
So, yeah, there's a lot of dynamics that take place here when it comes to production of lumber and the supply coming to the lumber yards. And, you know, there's a lot of working parts here. A lot of it started in Canada, okay? Because America, a lot of people don't realize this, but America, the United States anyway, I shouldn't say America, but the United States in general, for a while there, was importing a lot of lumber coming from Canada. Mm-hmm. And in turn, we were exporting a lot of logs to China. Okay. Now, this was 2017 when we saw that high, that $650 per thousand futures price. And then shortly after that, we started getting the trade wars. Okay. And China was like, okay, hey, we're not interested in your logs anymore. We're gonna switch our purchases of logs over to Russia and Ukraine. And at the same time, Canada had kind of a double whammy hit them, where they were what they refer to as stump price, and that's the price of their logs. Well, their stump price had dropped dramatically because they had this infestation of beetles that had come in to basically wipe out their forest. You know, they had like these dead trees everywhere. And so the forest management government up there was like, okay, well, let's go into harvest mode. Let's go into salvage mode. Let's cut these trees. And so Canada was sitting in a great position where they were selling price per thousand at $650, and they were just cutting a ton of trees. Well, then all this trade war started taking place. We stopped selling a bunch of trees to China. And in turn, we hit Canada with like a 25% tariff on all their softwoods. And they just got nailed. And they were like, okay, well, now what? So they had to start shutting down their mills. And as they started shutting down the mills, then the supplies, you know, chain started breaking down as well. Here in the United States, we saw something very similar. As these price per thousand dropped, the mills were not making as much money. So to kind of give you, you know, an idea, like, you know, just for like some of the viewers out there, if you sell 100 2x4s at $4.29, that's a $429 bill. But if you're selling 100 2x4s at $2.25, you're only getting $225 for that 100 2x4s, but your overhead, all your employees, everything else stays the same. So right. That means you have to sell that much many more 2x4s, and same thing with the mills. If you are producing all this lumber, but you're getting half the price for it, now all your overhead is getting more expensive. And so they start curtailing development, try and tighten up the inventory and get the prices to rise. And so there's a lot of working parts that take place inside of that. And that's kind of what happened. Same thing with the plywood industry. You know, we got a lot of plywoods that were coming in from Canada that, you know, again, because of the situations that I described before, you know, all of a sudden the imports from Canada started really dropping. And you would think that would be like a boost to the United States. But really, if you go and look at like the housing starts, you know, I mean, I don't want to like to switch gears on it, but really like housing starts, if I remember right, like had peaked out back in like 2017, if I remember right. Okay. And although like, you know, there's a lot of fluctuation happening there as far as, you know, what the numbers do, they never were quite as high as they were back then. So the sales or even the building of homes right now is a lot less than it was just a few years ago.
Yeah, that's very interesting because I mean, your channel is fantastic. You're in the weeds whenever you're kind of a hobbyist, just like I am. Yeah. And I think the smartest economists on YouTube are uneducated because you are the uneducated economist. And that's almost flunked out of high school. I've never taken an econ class in my life. Yeah. So I'm not going to toot my own horn, but I'll toot your horn for you.
Well, I appreciate it. You know, yeah. And, you know, the nice thing, like you said, is being a hobbyist in the industry, like, or as far as, you know, studying macroeconomics and the economy and stuff, I don't really have like investments. I don't have anything to kind of, you know, shift my gears towards one direction or another. I just kind of just look at things the way they are as best I can. I don't anticipate or hope for anything to take place. I just watch, and that's nice. You know, I'm like basically sitting with popcorn, you know,
yeah.
Keeping an eye on things, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But my point there is that you do study this stuff quite extensively. So I know that you've been researching inflation versus deflation. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, again, it's like you were saying, like, you know, it's a lot of it has to do with that debt component, like how much accessibility to debt do you have? And if people are making a payment towards something, they don't really care how much the item costs as long as they can make the payment. Right. And a lot of that has to take place, you know, is the same with like, you know, the lumber industry. Like when I saw a sheet of plywood going for $26.50, this is a half inch CDX, like the most common piece of plywood that you could ever buy for doing construction sheathing piece. And it's selling for $26.50. And I'm like, who in the world would be buying this? And then it dawned on me, somebody who's buying it on credit. That's who's buying it, because they don't care how much the piece is as long as they can make the payment on it. And that's the reason why you saw those prices going so high, is because most of it was being purchased on credit. Well, when the credit supply starts to contract on that and people are not having the accessibility to that credit to buy that lumber anymore, then the prices come down to meet the capabilities of the people who have the cash to buy it. And so there's a lot of reasonings for what I see, at least for deflation inside of the lumber prices. You know, I think a great argument about the inflation deflation came from I don't know if you caught that Macro Voices interview with Dr. Lacey Hunt, but
yeah, let's dive into that.
That was an absolute awesome piece. I had to listen to that thing like five times to even get my head. I was like, what is this guy talking about? I was like, holy moly. It was
a good one.
But I think probably the easiest way to kind of explain it to the viewers is that, you know, a lot of it has to do with money velocity and how quickly, you know, dollars change hands. But it also has to do with a lot of return on investment. And to kind of give the viewers an idea of how that kind of works is like, it, you know, there was a time that you could get a 6% interest on your 30-year bonds. And if you had $1 million that you had purchased in 30-year bonds, you would get like $60,000 a year from that, which for a guy like me, that would be like a pretty decent income. But now if you had $1 million in 30-year bonds, you would get like $13,000. You would have to have another job on top of your $1 million investment in bonds. And so the return on your investment has diminished quite a bit. So even though there's a lot more money out there, the interest rates are so low that the return on your investment doesn't give you the ability to spend that money into the economy unless you start spending your invested money. Yeah.
Right. That's why savers get screwed.
That's why savers get screwed. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to Lacey Hunt's argument there, and I'll just summarize it for the viewers the best I can. He basically believes there's going to be deflation because he doesn't think there's a way currently for the Fed to actually spend money. I think those are his words. And he categorizes or he defines money printing as it's kind of a little different than most people define it. And that's where it gets very, not necessarily complex, but it gets convoluted, I think, for the average listener, the average viewer, because these economists throw around the word money printing or the term money printing, and it can mean a variety of different things based on the context that they're using it. And so, as an example, the Fed prints money, but they're printing or they're creating bank reserves. They aren't necessarily printing dollar bills that just immediately go out into the economy. And the banks, the commercial banks, the retail banks, they're the ones that are really in charge of printing money the way most people think of printing money, creating additional supply, M2 or broad money in the economy. And they do that using those bank reserves as a backstop. Let's say you got a 10% reserve requirement. So those are your reserves, the bank reserves that you can lend against. But we talk about money printing as well, is it money printing in M2 or is it money printing in base money? And I think Dr. Lacey's point is that right now the Fed only has the ability to print money or bank reserves. and they could print 50 trillion, 100 trillion. It just doesn't matter. And we're still going to experience deflation because those bank reserves just sit at the Fed. And but he had a caveat there with Eric, because Eric really pushed him on this, which I thought was brilliant. He said, if we get to a point where the Federal Reserve Act changes from a standpoint that the Fed can actually spend money into the real economy, like helicopter money, instead of just the government doing it. So now the government spends it into existence, and the Fed, then the primary dealers buy the debt, and then the primary dealers sell the debt to the Fed. And that's how you can increase the money supply and hopefully get that velocity if you get the money to the right individuals in the economy. But currently the Fed can't do it. My argument, I think Eric's argument was, yeah, but they've ignored every other law. So why on earth are they going to, why would they not ignore this as well? But Dr. Hunt, his proposal was that, hey, they're going to stick to this one because this would be a hard rule to break. So he thought if they stay within the confines that they're in right now, we're going to have deflation because, to your point, prices are just going to go down. People are going to have less money. They're going to have less credit. And you have a destruction of credit. You have a lower money supply. So you just have the CPI continue to go down. There's not much they can do. He said, but if the Fed starts spending money into the real economy, then he says it's game over. Then he goes directly from deflation, not to inflation, but to hyperinflation. And I thought that was just really fascinating. What are your thoughts? And try to, if I didn't explain it well, go ahead and give it a shot.
No, I mean, I think you explained it pretty well. But, you know, the Fed, like you said, you know, they're kind of limited on what they can actually do with their money, or with the printed money, or, you know, with the reserves that they produce. I mean, they pretty much are buying things that have already been purchased, right? You know, I mean, they go to those primary dealers who have already purchased the treasuries, and then they purchase it off of those guys.
And it all stays within the financial system. It's transactions from one bank to another. So it doesn't create additional deposits.
You know, I think probably one of the things that because you hear like the Fed is not going to go into negative interest rates. Well, that would be like the next step for them, you know, to try and, you know, get the economy rolling again, you know, or at least get people to take out debt, is to take the interest rates even lower. But since they're already at the lower bound, they really don't have any room to go anywhere with it. And so, you know, one of the biggest arguments that I think is out there is that, you know, if interest rates go negative, and especially if it starts, you know, the negative interest rates, because, you know, really that stays in the financial system, like you're saying, the negative interest rates. It doesn't really come down to, like, you know, the people's money themselves. Like, it doesn't land in their bank deposits, and it doesn't go into their mortgages and stuff. Although we did see, what was it, Denmark or somebody who had negative, you know, they had it for a little bit. They had some negative yielding bonds on their mortgage-backed securities, and in turn was able to provide some negative interest rates to the home buyers, but it was very brief and it was very small. And I think the major argument is that they can't really do it because, you know, the moment that negative interest rates get used to that extent, then people would start pulling cash out of the system because they don't want to see their cash get, you know, taken away through a negative interest deposit, so to speak, on their bank accounts. And you know, the IMF put an argument out there a while back talking about how they were able to deal with this. And, you know, it's kind of funny that you're starting to see in the stimulus packages a lot of talk about digital dollars. And I think this is kind of a preliminary to the negative interest rates, is by issuing these digital dollars. Because in that IMF, I don't know if it was a report or a blog or something that they have, but I link it to some of my videos that I put out. But they were talking about how it is that you can give negative or put negative interest rates on people's deposits, and that's by issuing a digital currency. And what you do is you have the e-currency, which is like the digital dollars, and then you have cash in the system. And there's two different types of currency that you have. So when you deposit money at the bank, you're depositing it in e-currency, which will have a negative interest rate. And then that would force people to basically pull all the cash out of the system, which you don't want to have. So what they'll do is they'll devalue cash to the e-currency, so that over time, as you know, if you go to deposit $100 into the bank with cash, you'll only get $98 in e-currency. You see, so this is a way that they'll force people to put their cash back into the system, into the banking system, that'll have a negative interest rate on it. And this is like the IMF's idea on how it is that you can take negative interest rates into banks' deposits. And so I was looking at those, some of those proposals on the stimulus packages where they were wanting a digital dollar, and they were talking about how great this is for the people, because then you could load up debit cards and you can have like just accounts.
They have an app on their phone, the Fed app.
Have an app
for the Treasury.
And they're pushing it as like this great idea for everybody because it's going to make things so much easier. But then once you have things in a digital currency like that, now you have in a situation where the Fed can inject money directly to the people through their phone apps. And then you can limit what they can buy with it. Like say, you know, here, you're going to have all this money, but the only place you can spend it at is restaurants, or you can only spend it on certain items. And then if you don't spend it by the end of the month, you'll lose it. So they can create the money velocity and the money deposits and everything else through these digital currencies, and then wipe out the cash holdings that people have by devaluing the dollars, you know, the cash dollars to the currency that's available out there.
Yeah.
And with China already kind of implementing a digital currency within their country and actually using it, it seems to me that it's only a matter of time before the United States does it as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And for the people who are thinking, well, I would just go to the bank and use cash only, I think the government would come in and say, well, you can have your cash. If they don't ban it, they might ban it. But even if they didn't ban it, they'll say, but vendors, restaurants, lumber stores, you know, small businesses, all businesses, they can only accept e-dollars. They can't accept cash. And then I know a lot of people get pretty hardcore. They say, well, I just use cash anyway. Well, maybe, but it would be like dealing drugs in the sense that you could, but do you really want to risk going to prison for 10 years when you've got a wife and two or three kids that depend on you, or a husband that, or whatever, vice versa? Do you want to take that gamble just to go ahead and use cash? I think most people, the answer would be no. And I totally agree. I think that's exactly how it plays out.
Yeah. And a lot of people have this a misunderstanding about cash. They feel like they say that it's illegal not to accept cash. But that's not the truth at all. Even within the Fed's own statement, that there is no law that requires people to accept cash. It just happens to be, you know, written on the money that, you know, this is legal tender for all debts, public and private, but it's not required to use. And it's also like very... I've never had so many people, like, because I work a retail till, like, you know, I just bring customers up. I've never had so many customers come to me and ask me if I accept cash still. So there must be a movement out there of stores who are not accepting cash or are asking people to use their debit cards. So the shift away from cash is just kind of like taking place all on its own. It's not even like being forced. It's just, you know, just the idea that handing, you know, money over is kind of dirty, and people are kind of worried about the, you know, a virus being on the money itself. And so they're using debit cards. And, you know, and so it's just kind of like the shift has already taken place even without their efforts. You know, it's just like people are already kind of like stepping away. And I noticed like my cash sales have dropped dramatically, and a lot of people are just using their debit cards now. They're not even, I had one guy, I tried to hand him back his change. He said, no, thanks. And I'm like, well, it's like, you know, $1.50, man. You know, you don't want your change. He was like, nope, it might have the corona on it. And he walked away. He didn't even want to change.
Oh, so people aren't using cash because the virus, because in their mind, oh, wow, yeah.
Yep, he did. He walked, and I'm looking at the $1.50. And I'm like, oh, I set it on the till, you know, and I just left it there, you know. And so, yeah, I was thinking that, you know, I'll just use it for, you know, the next person if they run short on their change or whatever. But
That's really
interesting. Away money. Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by my friends at Capitalist Exploits, one of the few research letters I read myself. If you want more information on how this powerful tool can help you become a better investor, plus get a 15% discount, check out our affiliate link. We'll put it right in the show notes page. Yeah, so let's explore that a little bit as far as the virus. And I've been trying to think this through, and I know that the market is really getting excited because no more lockdown, or things are opening back up, and the government isn't going to require just the essential businesses and whatnot. But the way I see that, and yes, we've been able to flatten out the curve and keep from overwhelming the hospital system. But if you think, okay, it's still out there, if we're not at herd immunity yet, let's just assume for a moment we're not. Well, if people go right back to doing what they were doing, of course you're going to see the infection rate go right back up to where it was. And then I've heard the argument that, yeah, but we've seen the economic damage that it does, and the government isn't going to be able to come back in and do a second lockdown. And I totally understand that argument. But in my mind, I'm thinking, won't people institute their own lockdown to where it doesn't matter what the government's doing? The government's saying you can go run around, you can go to the dance club, you can go to the bar, you can go to the lumber yard, you can do whatever you want, and those businesses can be open. But if people see a second wave, and I'm just saying if people see a second wave of COVID come through the system because we've opened things back up, they're going to lock themselves down. And then from an economic standpoint, it has the exact same impact. What do you think there?
Well, I agree. And I think, honestly, the fear of getting this virus has been so pushed into the people now that they are going to have a very difficult time of going out there. And like, how many people are going to go to the ball game and sit that close, you know, at a basketball game or a baseball game where you have that many people that close, that tight, and you have one guy behind you who's hacking? I mean, people are going in their minds, even if the guy's not sick, you know, he's just the thought of it is going to have people so.
Especially when you got kids. I mean, you've got kids. I don't. So, I mean, how does that play out from a father's standpoint or the standpoint of the parent?
Well, yeah, even taking my kids into the store, like I am like, don't touch anything. Stay close to me, you know, like, and I'm not even really that worried about it. But I was just like, but yet I'm like watching them. Don't touch, you know, don't, you know. And so, yeah, taking, you know, just going off and being in public in general, I'm like trying to corral my kids, keep them from, you know, getting too close to anybody or getting close to anything that somebody else has touched. It's going to take some time to subside that fear. But if it even starts kicking up again, people are going to panic and they're going to lock themselves down, just like you said. I mean, here in my county, the cases are increasing. They're not diminishing. I mean, I have an app on my phone that lets me know when they get another case in, and I just kind of watch it to see what happens. And over the last, you know, 2 weeks, we've had more cases come through than the whole rest of the time. Really? It's like, yeah, well, a lot of it came from a seafood processing plant. And so, like, you know, a lot of these guys are working in a cold environment. They work very close to one another. And so when a couple of them got sick, they tested the whole plant. They realized that, you know, hey, there's like, you know, a bunch of guys here at this plant that are sick. So that contributed to a big number of the amount of cases that were here in the county. But even since then, there's been, you know, a half a dozen more cases that have come up. And it's just like, I know that seems kind of small, but I'm from a small area. So it's not like, you know, I mean, it's in the overall amount of people who are sick, that's like representing like, you know, 10% increase, you know, in the amount of cases just in the last week or so. And
and you guys are on lockdown there, right? Or kind of, or how does it, what are the rules?
We just did a partial opening. So now the restaurants are open, the bars are open, stuff like that. But the rules are so difficult for the restaurants right now. Like, you can't sit at the bar. You have to have tables that are like 8 feet apart from each other. You know, there's like all these, you know, you can only have like 25% capacity. It's very difficult for these businesses, but they're opening up because, you know, they want to make money, you know, they have to do something. And even if they were to run, like I, you know, we talked about earlier, even if they're to run at full capacity of what they are allowed to do, they're still not going to be a profitable business. I mean, they'd be lucky to break even just to pay the staff right now. And
yeah. And you made a great point in one of your videos that I watched this morning, that who's going to go to the bar? Like, why do you go to the bar in the first place? You know, you go there to do karaoke or have a few beers with your buddies or, you know, meet people. And you don't go there to stand in a corner 10 feet away from everyone else and just have a beer. I mean, it's
right.
So you just got that side of it too. Yeah. It's just,
Exactly. And, you know, it's because, you know, I work at a bar on Sunday nights. You know, I do a bingo calling. I do a little entertaining on that. And the whole point of the whole event is to bring people, as many people into the bar as you can. So we're not even doing that game anymore until we can open up completely. So it's just like that, and the theater that I was doing the play at, they're not opening up for the same reasons that, you know, once you have staff and you have everybody else who's, you know, operating this theater, it'll only allow you to bring in like 10 or 15, you know, audience, you know, 10 or 15 people for the audience. It's not enough to do any good as far as making money. It would be counterintuitive to work in. So yeah, the partial opening is not going to be very successful as far as I'm concerned, as far as helping the businesses out. It's going to be more detrimental than helpful.
Yeah, right. And then when you, if we have another wave come in, that makes it even more extreme. Even if the government keeps things opened up, it makes it more extreme from a standpoint of just people locking themselves in. But how is the, I mean, we're talking about all these small businesses in your area just not doing business. And how is that affecting the local unemployment rate?
You know, because a lot of these small businesses had applied for the payroll protection program, they're not really labeled as unemployed, right? They're still collecting a paycheck. And so they're still, you know, like in their mind, they're still getting paid, and that at some point they'll go back to work. But if you didn't have that payroll protection program, the unemployment rate would be a lot higher. And if you didn't have that extra $600 a month coming in from the Fed, from the federal government anyway, then most people probably wouldn't be spending their money at all. You know, they would be holding on to all of it. You got the forbearance, you know, and rental protection kind of thing, you know, where you can't get evicted. You know, all these things are kind of just, you know, have people kind of subside on as far as their concerns about whether or not they're going to have the money to continue on. So they're willing to, you know, they're willing to spend their money into the economy. Yeah. At least that's what I kind of see. But yeah, if you didn't have all those insurances taking place right now, it would be a lot more chaotic, I feel. I don't think we would have nearly the business that we had going on.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you've got people kind of intuitively they're concerned, you know, with their kids and with the maybe the elderly people around them. But they're probably thinking, okay, this is just a V-shaped recovery, because I remember how it was in January, and it's just they don't really understand economics like you do, so they don't understand that the underlying fundamentals of the economy were broken prior to the virus. So they just think we go right back V-shape. I'm going to go right back to my job, business as usual. So why not just have a little fun, spend this money, this free money that I'm getting from the government right now. So then thinking this through, if they go back out and then we have a second wave, they come back in. I mean, how long will the government need to fill the void? And then how long can they fill the void? Is there a limit to how much money they can just print and give out?
Yeah. Well, you know, now you're talking like, you know, getting into like some of the modern monetary theory stuff, you know, where they just start doing UBI and giving people like monthly checks from now on. You know,
that'll happen?
Well, I think it's a possibility. I don't think it'll work. I mean, I think it will work for a time, you know. In fact, people will probably even praise it after, you know, because who knows how long that could last. But, you know, as well as I do, that, you know, you can't just get paid and not work. I mean, there's got to be production and servicing taking place, and that's the economy, not just getting paid. I mean, somebody's got to be able to pay money too, you know. So somebody has to produce and somebody has to serve in order for the economy to work. And you can't just get paid money and expect everything to be, you know, hunky-dory after that. But do I, you know, I could see it. I could see it taking place. I could see like a UBI kind of thing happening and trying to get money velocity, keep the, get inflation going, stuff like that. But I just don't see it working, you know.
Yeah, I think they'll continue with this additional unemployment, if you want to call that helicopter money, UBI, whatever. They'll continue giving people money, especially to the election, because from mm-hmm. Trump's standpoint, I'm sure he doesn't want to cut this off when he's trying to essentially buy votes like they all do. And then if he loses, is the Democrat that comes in, are they going to be the one that says, hey, that $1,000 a month you've been getting, or that additional income you've been getting by taking care of your family instead of going to work, we're going to go ahead and pull that back now. I don't know. I don't see that one happening. And Trump is more of a Keynesian than the left. Yeah. So Trump is the biggest Keynesian of them all. And so even if he gets reelected, is he going to pull that back in? Maybe not. I especially if we go to a digital currency and the transfer mechanism is so easy from the government or from the Fed to get those currency units just directly to the app on your phone, and then see what happens as people build their lives around it. As Americans, I think it's hard for them to see this play out in real life, and it's hard for them to kind of get their minds around it. But as an example, I've spent a lot of time in Ecuador. And in Ecuador, they subsidize the cost of gas. So you can still buy gas in Ecuador for like, I forgot what it was when I left, but like 80 cents a gallon or something like that. It's just ridiculous. And because the government is losing money by pumping those barrels of oil, turning it into gas and selling it to people. But the whole entire economy has been built around 80 cents a gallon gas, right? And you think of the how that plays out. Everyone, you know, from the mom taking care of the kids, taking them to school, to the truck driver, to everyone in the economy, that affects. And then you look at Venezuela and see the exact same thing happened there, that they subsidized the cost of fuel for their population, and the whole economy got built on that. So what happens when you take away that subsidy? I mean, you can think through how that would happen in the U.S. if we dropped gas down to, let's say, 50 cents a gallon, and we did that for 10 years. And then after 10 years, we say, okay, we're going to go ahead and jack it back up to the market rate at $4 a gallon. I mean, there's no way.
No, it's a one-way street. It's a one-way street. Once you start, it's there is no going back. I mean, you might have the argument after, like, you know, before they started, that'll be the argument, the two sides saying this can't work, this will work, this can't work. And then once it's implemented, then it's an argument about how much. But it's right. Not going to take it away. You know, it's very much like the healthcare system. You know, when they were arguing Obamacare back in the day, you know, if you listen to one side of the argument, they would be like, this is going to destroy everything. You can't do it. There's no way. Absolutely not. Not going to do it. The other side says it has to be done. Right. But once it takes place, now it's not an argument about taking it away. It's about how do they mess with it. You see, it's not like, you know, it used to be this idea of like, don't do it. And then Republicans, and I don't want to just pick on Republicans because there's some of them that, you know, we're good for too. But then it turned into like a repeal and replace, like not just repeal. It was replace it with something different, you know, their own version of it or something like that. Because once it's implemented, then you can't take it away. It's like, there is no taking it away. And the same thing would happen with UBI. And so like, once you start giving people $1,000 a month or whatever it is that they want to give, then it's a matter of like, how much can you give? Can you get, like, you know, one argument will be, let's give more. The other one will be, let's give less. But there certainly won't be, let's take it away, because nobody's going to be, you know, voting for anybody who says we need to take this thing away. And so from once it's in place, it's a permanent thing. It's not going away.
The most dangerous thing that can happen if we go the UBI route, in my opinion, is if we don't have inflation right away. And the reason I say that is because, let's say all of the fear mongers like you and I are saying, yeah, you do the helicopter money and you're going to see prices go up, and it's just going to decrease the value of the dollars that are currently in the system. And although it may benefit some people, it's going to hurt others who have saved those dollars, or maybe people have bonds in their 401k or whatever. But what happens if they do this experiment, let's call it, and after a year or maybe even 2 years, there is no inflation, or at least what the government will admit to in the CPI numbers, it's still, call it 2-3%, something like that. Then everyone comes back and says, listen, uneducated economist, George Gammon, you guys were fear-mongering for no reason. It's just like 2008, where the Fed took their balance sheet from $800 billion all the way up to, call it, $4 billion. We printed all this money, and we didn't see inflation back then. You gold bugs were sounding the alarm in 2008. You're doing it again now, and you guys just need to take a back seat and let the adults in the room take charge.
You know, it's, yeah, what do you go with it? Because you think about it, like, Ben Bernanke, when he started the quantitative easing programs, people were screaming hyperinflation then. They were like, this action is definitely going to do a hyperinflation scenario. There's no way about it, because you can't print up this much money without it happening. And now we know the reasons why it didn't happen, why we didn't see the inflation there. But one of the arguments that Ben Bernanke said was, is that if we drop these interest rates down, it's going to make houses more affordable. But did that happen? I mean, here it is 10 years later, and the prices of houses far outpaced the wage growth.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, yeah, you can use the argument that it didn't cause the hyperinflation, or it didn't cause like that major inflation scenario like everybody said, but it certainly didn't do what they had promised it to do and make houses more affordable for people. It made the payments that they can make maybe more affordable, but the price of the house itself made it far outreaching to the average person. And now you have, you know, this disparity towards the people who can afford and the people who can't.
Let's talk about housing, because we talked about lumber. We talked about kind of the where it is in the trenches and kind of your insider insights that you have. But how do you see that playing out into housing prices, just broadly speaking, over the next 3 or 4 years?
Well, I mean,
in nominal terms.
Yeah. You know, if the Fed has their way, of course, the housing prices are going to continue to rise, and they certainly won't fall. And, you know, they're going to do everything they can do to try and keep that from happening. But I just have to kind of look back and think about, like, well, what about the pool of buyers? You know, what about these pool of buyers out there who are going to come in? Like, you know, we were saying the millennials and everybody else out there. You know, you have massive unemployment taking place. They say it's going to be the worst unemployment since the Great Depression. You know, they're talking about like wage growth not keeping up. They're talking about all these, you know, situations in which that are going to be very difficult for people to go out there and buy a house. And so I can only assume that, you know, the house prices are going to have to come down to meet the capabilities of the buyer at some point. You know, you can keep playing the game where we're like, okay, well, we'll offer this forbearance. Well, what if you didn't offer forbearance? Then what? What would house prices be right now if it wasn't for all these people, like, what, $1 trillion in missed payments right now? I mean, what would happen to the prices of all these homes right now if there wasn't forbearance taking place?
Right.
Yeah. So these actions that they're taking right now are keeping the prices bubbled. But it's only a matter of time, you know, in my opinion anyway, that at some point these things are going to have to come down to meet the capabilities of the borrower. And, you know, even now when you have like, even though the interest rates are low, it's getting... And, you know, I have a lot of people who kind of argue with me about this, but right now, even though the interest rates are low, the capabilities of getting a loan are getting difficult. You know, again, if you're in forbearance right now, you can't just go off and refinance your home. You can't take advantage of these low interest rates. You have to wait 3 months of non-skipped payments in order to acquire a new loan. So that just took a whole bunch of people out of the market, you know, who are not going to be able to like sell their home and buy a new one, so to speak. And at least in the course of 3 months, you have to have 3 months worth of payments made. And then all the people who are unemployed, who are collecting a check and maybe even making their payments. Well, if you don't have an income coming in, most likely you're not going to get a loan either. So the pool of buyers is shrinking by the day with everything that's taken place here. And if they didn't have all this insurance, I would feel that the house prices would be dropping dramatically. You know, there's a lot of things that are taking place behind the scenes, you know, at least with these mortgage lenders and stuff. I know, like, and it's really hard. Like, it took me a while to kind of understand what was taking place there with those mortgage lenders and their hedge against the mortgages that they sign, you know, because when they sign a mortgage, they basically just sell that off. They don't want to hold the mortgage. They want to get you to buy, sign the contract so they can sell it off.
Yeah, but there's a time in there that they don't close on the loan. I mean, you had a fantastic video on this. You want to explain that, Simon, because I think it's just it's just fascinating.
Yeah, and really, and nobody kind of foresaw this. The Fed, I mean, I can't imagine the Fed didn't see this happening. I mean, those guys have, like, you know, every economist looking at every angle, and to think that, oh, geez, we missed this, you know, it's just,
yeah, but the unintended consequences.
Yeah,
They're not that bright, I don't think.
Yeah, well, maybe, you know, I mean, I certainly didn't think about it until after I started reading about it. But what ended up happening is that when the Federal Reserve stepped in with that quantitative easing, part of that quantitative easing was buying mortgage-backed securities.
And this is the most recent round that they actually admit to.
Recent round. Yeah, this all happened in the last month and a half here.
Okay.
And yeah, not private, but or previously, but
not
yeah.
QE. It's actually QE, yeah, not QE. QE.
So what ended up happening was that when the Federal Reserve bought these mortgage-backed securities, they bought an intense amount of them. And the whole idea was to keep the prices elevated in the mortgage-backed securities. Because once the prices start to drop, then the interest rates start to rise, just like any bond out there. And if they had people out there dumping these mortgage-backed securities, then the mortgage lender wouldn't have mortgage-backed, you know, the mortgages to sell, you know. So the prices have to stay elevated in order for these lenders to be able to sell those mortgages off. But something very interesting took place with these mortgage lenders out there, because they have a hedge against that mortgage. Like you were saying, there's a time from the time they sign the contract or get you to sign the contract to the time they're able to sell it. And if interest rates were to rise just a little bit on that, they would lose money on that contract that they had signed, that mortgage that they were trying to sell. So they buy a hedge against that. It's like an insurance policy. And that insurance policy that they buy, it's like their own like investment. It's its own like, you know, it's its own thing that's separate from the mortgage itself. And the idea is that they bought that thing on margin, which basically means is that they're using that as the collateral to buy it. And if the interest rates were to drop, the price of that or that insurance policy, basically the value of that thing falls. And since they bought it on margin, the broker is doing, hey, we're doing a margin call on that thing. You need to come up with a bunch of money because the collateral that you're using to buy it just fell out in price. Yeah,
money and they don't have.
Yeah, money they don't have. And since these mortgage lenders are not really working on a ton of capital, they're just basically, you know, signing these mortgages and selling it off and then keeping the profit in between. When those margin calls got called in on them, they're like, whoa, wait a minute. We don't have like the billions of dollars. I think it was like $500 billion that they caused in that. And a bunch of these mortgage lenders are like, you know, we're going to go out of business if you keep dropping these interest rates at the pace that you're doing it. Yeah. And a lot of people.
To be clear for the viewer, because if the Fed comes in and buys up enough of these mortgage-backed securities, that drops the interest rate, but it drops it so quickly. And it goes against their hedge so fast because they're hedging interest rates going up. So it happens so quickly that they get a margin call where they have to come up with cash to meet the margin call. They don't have the cash, and the Fed basically wipes them out because there's no liquidity in the system. And because the Fed created so much demand that they dropped interest rates so low so quickly.
Right. Exactly. And that's, you know, and that was a big problem for these mortgage lenders. And so you think about it, if a mortgage lender is sitting in that position where they don't have, you know, what I guess to say the confidence, you know, that they'll be able to sell this thing in time, then most likely they're not going to be as, I don't know how to quite put it, except for easy with the lending like they were. They're going to be a lot more stringent on it.
And they're probably going to charge more.
And that's the thing. They're going to start charging more. So it's like almost a bad thing that the Federal Reserve had done by trying to put a floor under these mortgage-backed securities to keep them from falling in price and actually cause the prices of them to rise. It screwed those lenders over in a kind of an odd way, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And then did you do any research on the mortgage servicers?
Yeah, a little bit on the mortgage servicers as well, because, you know, with all this forbearance taking place now, sure, it's, you know, you got like the government backing and stuff like that taking place. But a lot of these mortgage servicers, people don't quite realize is that there's kind of a middleman. When you make your mortgage payment, you're making it to a mortgage servicer who and then in turn is paying the mortgage backed security. But during this forbearance time, people aren't making their payments to the mortgage servicer, but the mortgage servicer has to continue to pay the mortgage backed security.
So they're on the hook.
They're on the hook for it. And a lot of times people don't realize this, that I'm sure a lot of people realize it when they're making their mortgage payment, that they're also including their taxes and insurance in that as well, that they stop making the taxes and insurance payment on the mortgage because it's a single payment that they're making. And they don't realize that the mortgage servicer is also liable for that as well, because they're the ones who are handling these mortgage payments. And so that they don't get reimbursed for. And so there's a, you know, issue with the mortgage servicers. So now if you have an issue with those guys, and the mortgage lenders, now you got a troubled market that's taken place. And, you know, I can only see that being more trouble or more headwinds for the housing market coming into the future.
Fantastic insights there. What, and I know I've been keeping you forever here. I appreciate your willingness to sit down and chat for so long. What do you think about gold, silver, Bitcoin? I've been trying to ask all my the people I interview about those three things.
You know, I am a big fan of all three. I am a very big fan of all three of those items, and I am especially a big fan of silver. And I think probably like what I like most about silver is that it's a vital commodity. You know, you can have a lot of things out there that are an investment. And I don't really look at like silver as an investment. I look at it as an insurance policy for myself. It's something that's outside of the system. It's something that is, you know, it's in my hand. I don't have to worry about a bank closing or somebody not, you know, or an envelope coming in the mail or, you know, anything like that. It's something that's in my hand. It's mine, and I can trade it. I've built up a network of people around me that I know I can trade silver for. So to me, it's like, it's an insurance policy for me. And then when I look at it comparatively to gold, it's like, man, this thing is like incredibly undervalued. You know, I mean, they pull gold out of the ground to silver at a 10-to-1 ratio. So for every ounce of gold, you get 10 ounces of silver, but it trades at over 100-to-1. So it's like comparatively, the price of silver to gold is like, it's like tiny in comparison. So either gold has to come down or silver has to go way up to meet that comparison. And so you take the industrial side of things, you know, that the demand for silver is a vital commodity. You know, you can have Bitcoin and you can have silver, but you don't need Bitcoin to have silver, but Bitcoin needs silver to exist. You see where I'm kind of getting at that? It's like, you know, silver is its own thing away from it all. I like Bitcoin because it has a lot of the same characteristics of silver as far as being outside of the system. It's its own thing. But you are, you know, kind of reliant on networks working and, you know, stuff like that. But I've used Bitcoin quite a bit to do sales and stuff. And I found it to be a very convenient form of transactions, especially if you're, you know, transacting with somebody who's not in your location. You can transact with anybody around the world almost instantaneously, and you don't have to go through any other mediator or pay fees to do it. Well, you got to pay a little bit of fees, but I use Litecoin, so it's like pretty small in the fees. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you know, I really like those things. But then gold, on the other hand, is like the monetary metal of kings, you know? So like when you look at central banks, that's what they hold. They don't hold a lot of silver. They hold gold. Countries hold gold. You know, rich people who are trying to hedge their bet against inflations and different things like that, they hold gold. And so gold is like the prized possession when it comes to monetary metals. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the way I feel about all three of those things. And yeah, you know, the prices, you know, they may change and fluctuate around and stuff like that, but ultimately, it's a commodity that's in your hand that's separate from everybody else.
What would happen if interest rates on treasuries go negative and you've got a country like China that gets a lot of dollars? So they take those dollars, they buy treasuries, but now all of a sudden they've got a negative carry on those treasuries. Do you think instead of just going to cash, because they've got the peg with the yuan, so they've got to have dollars, do you think we could get to a point where they would just buy oil?
I kind of wonder why it is that China even wants the treasuries outside of like the United States being the global reserve currency and then, you know, doing world trade with your dollars. Then that kind of makes sense to hold on to treasuries. But as far as like, you know, holding it on because it's like a prized possession or something like that, I just don't see it. And there's no reason to think that there's couldn't be a new form of world currency that takes place. You know, when they start this whole digital currency and they start really ramping that up and giving other countries the ability to transact with them using that digital currency, this is going to take a lot of power away from the United States. And when you got the United States who implements sanctions and, you know, uses that economic power against people, you know, against other countries, it really gives them a lot of incentive to step away from those treasuries and start moving into that digital yuan or something else. So yeah, I see, like, you know, the treasuries being held by China is a great speculation, because most likely the, you know, the treasuries at some point are going to go negative and they'd be able to sell those things for a profit. But holding on to oil, an actual commodity that they can use, is a much better proposition as far as I'm concerned, you know, when it comes to, you know, China and what's better for their country. You know, it's no surprise how much, you know, like, there's a big secrecy on how much gold they have. And it's almost as if they're anticipating that they're going to step away from the treasuries at some point. Now, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, but I certainly do see it taking place in the future at some point, you know, especially with that implementation, that instituting of that digital yuan. It seems like they're almost gearing up for it, like, very slowly. You know?
Yeah. All right, buddy. Well, we'll go ahead and leave it there. Awesome, awesome interview. For any of my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, or you produce content that's just absolutely amazing, where can they go to find out more about what you do and the content you produce?
Yeah, I just have my YouTube channel, Uneducated Economist, you know, on YouTube. And I don't really have any other place. I do a little bit of Twittering, and I have, like, the you know, Facebook thing, and, you know, a little bit of Patreon and stuff like that. But pretty much everything I do on YouTube. I do most of my commenting there and stuff like that. So yeah, YouTube, Uneducated Economist, and that's where you can find me. And if you want to send me an email, that'd be great. uneducatedeconomist@gmail.com. Yeah, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are. If you have any links that you'd like to send me, I mean, I love reading what other people have, to, you know, their opinions on different things. So yeah, that's how you can reach me.
All right, buddy. Well, I appreciate it again. And I can't wait to have this chat in 2 months and revisit everything we talked about today.
Yeah, sounds great, George. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com, or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.